Forever Dog.
Welcome to another episode of Best Show Bests, the greatest hits of the best show, with me, your host, Tom Sharpling. If you like what you hear, make sure you join us every Tuesday night on Twitch at 6 p.m. Pacific for a brand new episode of the Best Show, featuring callers, celebrity guests, live music, and plenty of surprises. Enjoy! Hey everybody, welcome back to another installment of S and W, Q and A, and that is Sharpling and Worcester, and I'm Tom Sharpling, and this is John Worcester is on the screen.
Hello.
From parts unknown. He's on
can't
the
tell you where I am.
Can't, he's on a journey now. And we're gonna answer questions that people sent in over at the Patreon, which a lot of great questions over the last couple episodes, and I think there's more here. I'm trying not to look at them ahead of time because I want them to be fresh.
Sure.
Rachel asks, this is a good one. Rachel asks, favorite SCTV characters and sketches.
I think you and I might have a favorite, like in our top three, and it's one I kind of forgot about until you brought it up maybe 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what it is?
Well, I can say the one I always think of is the William B. Williams talk show is okay. The thing. What are you thinking? Because I think of so many of them. It's like
mine was what's his name's brother?
Skip Bittman.
From Different Strokes.
Oh, Conrad Bain. You're thinking of Conrad Bain.
Yeah,
brother of Conrad Bain. The real life brother.
Yeah.
Whose name was, he was also an actor, but like the dad on Different Strokes was Conrad Bain. His brother was also an actor.
And looks just like him.
Looks just like him. And you think it's a put on, and he was on with one of our favorite characters is going to be Larry Siegel.
Yes. Maybe my favorite SCTV character.
Rick Moranis doing like Joel Silver is, I guess, what people always say. It's like he's like a Hollywood producer who's so obnoxious and unfocused.
Wired.
He's super wired. Yeah. He's super wired. He's doing 10 things at once. He'll just be like, no, this isn't right. He's like, well, hold on. I got a call. Ma.
You don't know.
Like, he's like, what's, yeah, you don't know. He's like, what's the name of that soup? Hold on. My mother will know. Ma, what's the name of that soup?
The thing you put in it. What's it called?
What?
A turnip.
Yeah.
And so he's in this episode. Basically, it's what's it called? Different Folks. Is that the show that they're doing?
Yeah, and they got two kids of color to act against Conrad Bain's brother, who clearly had no problem playing of his brother on a sketch show.
Sure, I'll do it.
Yeah, and the kid he kept getting, and he like Rick Moranis is in full like a-hole mode at this, where he comes on because the kid had a catchphrase, right? Then one of the little kids had a catchphrase. He's like, "What? Well, no, you're doing it wrong. You do it right.
Why not, Pop?
Why not, Pop? Oh my
God! Why not, Pop?
He's like, "Why not, Pop? Why not, Pop? Why not, Pop?
You happy with that, Reed?" It's like five years old.
Yeah, he's yelling at children. Yeah,
all right, so that's one of my favorites. Talk about the William B. Williams show.
Well, do you remember this one? This was the Sammy Maudlin show. Was the SCTV late night talk show that was like the fake showbiz ass kissy I love you so much, or it would be Bobby Bittman was like the top comedian who would always come on. That was Eugene Levy played Bobby Bittman. And he was just not funny. But the host of the show was Joe Flaherty as Sammy Maudlin. His co-host is John Candy as William B. Williams, who's just the guy who's always like, he's like, I just want to say this is one of the, in the history of humankind, Sammy Maudlin is one of the greatest people that's ever existed. Like, just like that kind of level of just back padding. But then the ratings came in, or the audience had been surveyed. I forget what, like, there was like test marketing. Right. People were saying they didn't like William B. Williams on the show anymore. So he announces he's leaving the Sammy Maudlin show and he's going to do his own talk show now, the William B. Williams. And I remember thinking it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It was like, it's the William B. Williams show. And he comes out of the curtain. John Candy gets tangled in the curtain when he's supposed to come out for his debut episode of his talk show. Gets tangled in the curtain, trips, twists his ankle, and is immediately saying, I can't do this. Like, he's immediately saying, like, I don't want to do this.
And it really reads like he's in pain. Like,
oh,
he,
yeah.
He really plays it well. Like, you're just thinking, oh, my God, I think his leg is broken.
Because he's like, but then the guests were, Martin Short was on as Irving Cohen, the songwriter, the ancient guy, remember?
Where William B.
Yeah. He comes out, he's like, and this resonated in my head from the second I saw it until now, where he's like, you can write a song about any name. Is that true? He's like, that's true. Give me a name. He goes, Roy. And then Irving Cohen goes, Roy. What the hell kind of name is Roy? You want me, like, he just like gave the wrong name.
Right.
And
right.
He just, but then Sammy, like, his monologue bombed. He was doing a thing. He made some joke about McLean Stevenson. It's like dropping the bombs over on the Middle East.
Ooh.
and then some guy yells out, what about Lebanon? You think that's funny too? And then he's like, Sammy Maudlin comes out at the last second, like the way guests would walk out on talk shows and like surprise the audience. He goes, oh my God, we got Irving Cohen's here. He's had more hits than McLean Stevenson's had bombs. And then he just goes, now that's how you tell a McLean Stevenson joke. It's just like, I don't think anything has impacted me as much as SCTV ultimately.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The Bobby Bittman interviewed by Dick Cavett is great. He's written and who would be playing Dick Cavett? It's
that would also be Rick Moranis, I think.
And Dick Cavett, so condescending, thinks Bobby's just the biggest tool. And eventually, over the course of the 5 minutes that they're talking, Bobby realizes that he's being talked down to, and it's really killing him. Like, it's almost like the first time he's been treated like this.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Yeah. It's so well played. So great.
It was, for me, that was my... Like that, and I guess Letterman also would be like the first times I realized as a kid that like show business stuff is so fake.
Right.
And seeing people make fun of how fake the behind the scenes is and all that stuff. It just was so kind of like liberating, because you as a little kid, you see these things and you just like think it's reality.
Right.
And then suddenly there were these people poking holes in it, and that like informed everything for the rest of my life.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's why I my favorite shows are Veep and 30 Rock and that sort of thing, where it's kind of exposing the horrors.
Yeah,
like in these industries,
like the underside of things.
With humor, yes.
Yeah, like the soft white underbelly.
That's right. When they wanted to play some secret shows, like, that's what you play under.
And we are, of course, are talking about Blue Oyster Cult playing L'Amour.
Wait, what? I've got a signed copy of Secrets Revealed, Martin Popoff's Labor of Love Blue Oyster Cult book signed by Albert and Joe Bouchard.
Wow, that's
just feet away,
just sitting there.
Oh my God.
Now that Blue Oyster Cult were huge, but then when they would want to do club gigs, they would play L'Amour's in Brooklyn, right? L'Amour's?
Yeah, L'Amour or the Brooklyn Zoo.
Yeah. And they would play billed as Soft White Underbelly, which was like the giveaway that it's Blue Oyster Cult.
Yes.
Then there must have been a sad day when they're just like, I think we're playing L'Amour as Blue Oyster Cult.
Guys, the name, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
We gotta do everything we can to get 1,000 people here.
Yeah, so. We gotta.
There are no secrets anymore.
I think this whole secret show concept, we might have to just hit pause on that for a little bit.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
let's do this. Let's just do this one under a BOC.
Just one. Just one.
What is your favorite Blue Oyster Cult album? We talked about it on yes, this show already.
But I don't love any of their albums, like, in their entirety.
Yeah, yeah, that seems to be.
But I love that kind of middle period. That's kind of atmospheric and super dreamy. Like, you know, like I love Agents of Fortune. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Spectres I like.
Mm-hmm.
But every album has a couple good ones.
Yeah, that's
fair. You know, their last album has one of the greatest power pop songs of the last 15 years.
Which album is that?
It's called The Symbol Remains.
Okay.
And the song is called Box in My Head.
I'm going to listen to it today. Yeah. The East Coast rock, still doing it.
Not for everybody.
No. But with SCTV also, I think a big part of Newbridge came from Melonville. It just gave, like, they had their fake world and their fake town that they were serving through this television station. I think that just gives permission for us to build out more of a world.
You can do anything.
There are
more bridges coming every episode. North Bridge, Horror Bridge.
Yes, the my favorite might be Prison Bridge.
Prison Bridge, yeah.
That's very rough in Prison Bridge.
Not as bad as Jail Bridge. No, Jail Bridge is not as bad as Prison Bridge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Sharon asks, do you guys have a map of the Newbridge greater area to keep track of all the zones? And if so, will we ever be able to see it?
Oh, you certainly could have.
In the box set.
Yes.
There was a big Newbridge map in the box set. The Numeral Group box set that it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
But
it's gotta be online somewhere, I would think.
I would hope so.
PDF form.
Yeah, you can get a little thumbnail of that. Maybe not the same majesty as the poster had, but let's see. Tony wants to know, and this one's more for you. Does your extensive knowledge of KISS ever haunt you? And to have to carry that around must be trying.
Oh yeah, it's terrible. I'm the KISS guy, but I feel like I've been pretty adamant that I don't really like their music. Mm. But I need to know everything about them. I think they're just incredibly fascinating. So people confuse that with me genuinely liking them. So I get dolls sent to me. Mm-hmm. I get all kinds of stuff sent to me, and I usually give give them away to children.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate it. But yeah, it does kind of suck that people think I genuinely like them.
Sure.
When I genuinely like just knowing about them.
it is, they are endlessly fascinating as people and as a band. The least fascinating, it's like the way I feel about, I think, like wrestling. I love watching wrestlers argue and do the, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to do, like all that stuff. But then right. watching a wrestling match, I'm like, oh, okay. They're bouncing off the ropes and doing all. I love the spectacle and the pageantry of wrestling and the characters, but just not the actual wrestling. I think that's like KISS for you. You're hooked on every part of it except when they pick up their instruments and play some songs.
Yes, I will read for the fifth time the book their accountant wrote about them.
KISS and Sell.
Before I will listen to a record.
Yeah. But what that said, as a kid,
yeah.
Did you did like them as a kid to some degree?
Oh yeah. 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 Like a lot of kids my age, this fell on my birthday, Halloween of, I think, 1976, on the Paul Lind Halloween special. That's where KISS played a couple songs. And, you know, I 76, I would have been 10. I was turning 10. So it's like the perfect age for the combination of rock and roll and comic books or whatever, cartoons. And, you know, just loved it. But I think I was into them. It's funny. It probably wasn't that long a period, you know? So from like 76 until, probably 79, like I was starting to feel like, oh, maybe this isn't cool.
That's, you know, amazing.
Like, I think Aerosmith is cool now, but I don't think this is cool anymore.
That is so interesting that even yeah. as a child.
Yeah.
Figuring out what's cool and not cool. KISS was like one of the first things to get to be put under the magnifying glass to be like, right. Where does this fit? And was it the way the music changed, or was it that they were just in clown makeup?
I think it was, in 79, that album Dynasty came out, and I was pretty off by that point. And, okay. you know, I didn't think that was a great record. And by like 79, I was probably getting into like the Boomtown Rats and the Police and the Ramones and stuff and the Clash. So that was pretty, you know, pretty much in the rear view window at that point. But when I worked at a chain record store in the mid to late 80s in Greensboro, and forgive me, but I could spot a KISS fan, like a current KISS fan, the moment they walked in the the door, just because like there was something about them that just was a little off and just kind of wasn't cool. I know that sounds horrible.
I know what you mean. When you're, it's like, it's everyone's worst nightmare that you're going to be that to somebody, and we all are that to somebody. I know there's been countless times where I've walked into a thing and somebody's like, oh no, what does this guy think he's doing?
Every day for me. Like, I'm, like, what is that guy wearing?
Yeah.
What is he doing? His shoes are like ridiculous. I get it every day, but I don't mind.
A guy like going up as an adult to like any kind of like will call or whatever to be just like, I think I'm on the list for the show tonight. And then they like look at me and I'm just like, the band's list. It makes me feel like I'm like, they think this guy's probably 50-50. This guy's trying to talk his way into the show or something.
Right. Right.
Yeah. band's list, Sharpling, SCH. And then they, here we go. Thank you. I don't know.
Oh, you are here.
Yeah, you are. Oh, yes, it's you.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
None of us thought you were on the up and up.
Yeah. It is so funny, that energy that somebody gives off where you're just like, oh, sweetie, you're not. Yeah. You got the Animalize? You got Animalize on cassette? You're like, I knew it. Here you go, buddy.
Thank you.
What would you say the best Kiss, what is a legitimately great Kiss song, in your opinion?
Well, I will go to bat saying that Alive and the album that came after it, Destroyer, are two really great albums. Like, mm-hmm. they're like, I think they're great. And it almost makes me feel like what went wrong that the that they sure. put two really good ones out in a row. I love the song Black Diamond. I think that's a great song.
Mm-hmm.
What else? There's a total kind of 80s power pop song on what's the album called? Crazy Nights.
Mm-hmm.
And the song is called Turn on the Night. And it's a co-write of Paul's with I think it's Diane Warren, who
wow,
was like
okay.
super top 40
mm-hmm.
songwriter. So I like that. I like Deuce. It's got to be more, right? What's the one that Kim Fowley kind of co-wrote? I'm the king of the nighttime world.
Yeah, that's the one that was supposed to be a big hit, right?
Yeah.
Was that was one that people they went into it thinking that that was one up their sleeve, right? Am I correct?
I think so.
Yeah,
yes.
That they were just like, like, yeah, this one, we're good with this one. What about a Gene song? What's a Gene song you like?
Well, Deuce is one of Gene's.
Sure.
I like right. a lot of his titles. Cadillac Dreams is one that's mm-hmm. a great one. Mm-hmm. Ladies in Waiting. I could make a worst of Kiss comp
uh-huh.
that would knock anyone's socks off. And yeah. It would be a lot of Gene's songs.
Yeah. Ladies in Waiting. I mean, look, you turned me onto a lot of this deep catalog Kiss stuff.
I'm sorry.
No, it's been a gift. It's the Ladies in Waiting. There's a point when it gets so stupid that it gets smart again somehow with it.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually like profound in its stupidity. Cause it's like four
yes.
notes. The lyrics are as basic as a human could put like thoughts together.
Yeah.
So you went to the market and the meat looks good tonight. And the ladies in waiting will show you what it's all about. Is that,
yes, it's a perfect example of a song that sounds like it was being written while it was being recorded.
Like, these are just dummy words that'll.
Or, and it's so ham-fistedly yeah. basic too
yeah.
that it just feels like they're just kind of like they've been assigned to write, like, I don't know if this is a turd rock song.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of making it up and he's just saying what's on his mind. But that's the record. That's the final product too. Like
yeah.
no more thought went into it
yeah.
beyond
yeah.
what they did during those 3 minutes.
Yeah. Great Expectations is also a great one.
Wonderful song.
Which
that might be the most arrogant song ever written.
Really? It is. Cause it's basically saying I'm on stage. I see you in the audience. You're clutching yourself in ecstasy, looking at me and and wondering what it would be like to be with me. You've got great expectations.
Yeah. And I like what he prefaces the chorus with, well, listen, comma.
Yeah. Well, listen. You. Well, listen. And it's got a children's
got
choir on it also, too.
Yes. Yeah, these poor kids, they were like from the Harlem whatever
mm-hmm.
choir. So it's all these kids from, you know, from Harlem in this studio having to sing along with this monstrosity.
Yeah, like this dirty this garbage.
Yeah, dirty song.
they're just looking, they're talented and they got the request came in and there was
yeah.
probably a little bit of money paid. And they're just like, yeah, well, we get to be on a record. Cool. And then, like, and it's just dirty garbage. And you stand and clutch your breast.
Your breast.
The music drives. Yeah, it's just disgusting.
Along with our music drives you wild. Along with the rest.
Just after, just first thought all the way down the line, and this is from the album that they probably spent the most time on of the albums.
Yeah.
Steven asks, what was it like the first time you appeared on stage together? I remember arriving late at Matador 21 in Las Vegas and getting there just in time to see you playing the Canadian band Alphabet Game. I don't remember that.
I have no memory of this.
And bummed I missed Guitar Wolf. Forgot that they were there, but
oh right.
But the rest of the night was a fantastic experience, and your segments were a big part of that. Did that inspire you to do more live appearances? Well, when Steven mentions Matador 21, that was a Matador Records had a 21st anniversary weekend in Las Vegas around 2011, something like that.
I think so. Yeah, sounds
like 2010. I think it might have been 2010. And they had three nights of shows, and John and I were asked to MC the third night, I think. Right? The third? I think it was...
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
I'm pretty sure I can narrow it down. It was Jeff Jensen did the first night.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Nastanovich did the second night, and then mm-hmm. we did the third night.
Yeah.
And that was us introing the bands and doing little bits here and there as we did that. And yeah, that was the first full thing we did, right?
Yeah, and it went so well that really gave us the confidence to think about doing it in the future. I was kind of shocked how well it went, just because, you know, comedy and rock concerts doesn't really mix. I mean, I can probably count on one hand the times I've seen it work, you know, with a comedian who just isn't met with like, fuck you, where's the band, you know, that sort of thing. So I thought it went great. I think we did a little interview with Ted. Is that right? With Ted Leo?
We did the Ted Leo interview during the show where really we good. Just kind of like, where we were just very aggressive and we did that a couple times over over time, which was to do these interviews with people where we were just so awful to them, like rapid fire awful also, like from both. I would be on one side of them, you'd be on the other side. They're sitting in a chair and we're asking them terrible questions.
Yeah.
And they're not sure who's going to hit them harder. That was fun. Because it was.
And was I a priest also? I have a memory of
Pablo
of like
Fontana. You might have been.
I might have like done a blessing for the show or something stupid like that.
I think
that.
You did you did Bishop Pablo Fontana. Blessed the show. I know Roy was a part of it. It was me and you doing that thing like getting deep with so and so. I think we were calling it or whatever.
Yeah.
Where we'd interview somebody.
And it was a great audience. Like it was a perfect audience because a lot of them knew who we were and what we did. And it wasn't like just a hostile.
No, it wasn't like, why is there any comedy at this? And yeah, that was a lot of fun because it was just such a favorable crowd. It was the best way to kind of get our feet wet with that.
Just like Sasquatch.
Just like, oh, well, well, let's tell that story.
Yeah.
So we did the show, which then like a few years later, we're just like, hey, let's do some live shows. Sharpling and Worcester live. Boom. We started in New York. We did the Bell House, four shows, amazing run there. Then we did Chicago. We did shows all over the country over the course of a year or so. Yeah. We hit a lot of the West Coast, but then we got asked to do this festival, which was the first time we had been asked to do a festival called Sasquatch, which was in Washington State, probably about an hour and change outside of Seattle. Is that fair? Like,
yeah, the Gorge.
The Gorge. Okay.
Yeah.
And we were told, oh, no, this is a favorable one for what you guys are doing. They're going to have a comedy tent. It's not, you're not going to be in a bad situation. This crowd gets it. Because that was our big concern, was our thing is not meant for just anyone. You kind of, it by far works best when the audience has some awareness of who we are.
Right.
It's not just stand-up where it's like, hey, here's a stand-up doing comedy. And then just, it's like we're doing characters. It's very vulnerable to be doing straight man. Hey, so tell me the thing. And then, and you're wearing a costume and you're just like,
right.
We're both very vulnerable when you're doing that stuff. I remember we pull in Sasquatch. There was a show on already that had like a half decent crowd at the comedy tent.
Todd Barry was involved.
Todd Barry was involved. Might've been Dave Hill's show.
If you said her name, she's a really good actress and funny. She was on, her last name begins with a P, I think. What's her name? I feel like it was her show or she was a guest on it too.
I think she was a guest on it. It was,
what was it?
Oh, what is, man, I'm drawing a blank on that.
I can't remember.
Yeah, but Todd was a part of it. And I remember coming in seeing they were getting like an okay reaction from the crowd and just being like,
yeah,
oh, these poor guys. Bummer for them tonight, huh? Like, and it's also like 2 p.m.
Yeah.
Like, rah. So, hey, you gave it your best shot, guys. What can you do? Like, feeling like, when we get up there, look out. And it actually was true. It was look out, but maybe the way that we didn't think it was look out. I remember meeting somebody backstage, a musician. I'm not going to name them. I knew their music, indie rock musician. Oh, I'm so excited to meet you. Oh, my God, I'm looking so forward to seeing you do the... To do this is so great. Awesome. See them in the... So now it's this enormous tent. Enormous, like a field in front of us. We go up, and we're doing like, was it like 50 minutes? 5-0? Like,
oh my God, was it that long?
I think it was. God. It was like under an hour. It was me, you, and Michael Slabach was our... tour manager, organizer.
No, it was Matthew Barnhart.
Oh, it was Matthew Barnhart. Michael was not there this time. You're right.
Yeah.
Matthew was there. So we drive there. We get out. We set our props up. Here's the music. Here's his cues on the CD for the different moments. We hit the stage, not realizing at least half the audience left to go see Savages, which was...
Right.
This really hot band at the moment.
Yeah.
This was like they were having their moment. They're playing at a stage way too close to our stage. So now there's just dun 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 bleeding from the distance coming through. Certainly not doing us any favors. We go up and just within how many seconds do you think? When did you realize this was not going our way?
Probably after like the first, whatever the first thing we said, or like the first line was just like, oh, yeah, this is going to be a long 50 minutes.
It's going to be a rough one. And then suddenly it's like, because there were lines that we knew we had in our pocket for the sketches we wrote that we knew just like, well, that's money in the bank, that one.
Right.
And then, like, the first one of those is just... You hear the...
Nothing.
And you just hear... Like, we do the first line, and you expect... Instead of hearing laughter, we hear... Boom, 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 boom. We hear Savages off at the main stage or wherever. people would come into the tent to cool off, walk halfway up to see us, and then decide they'd rather be hot.
Right.
I remember seeing, outside and hot.
Seeing one familiar face while this was happening.
Oh my
and I
God.
Just remember saying, it must have been like something we just kind of riffed, and I looked out and I just said, Ira knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Ira Kaplan, Yola Tango were playing, they were on the bill. So Ira comes over to watch. This is not the person I'm talking about.
No.
Ira is laughing so hard at watching us just royally eat it. It is like bad, bad. The person who I was excited to, who said, oh, I can't wait to see the show. From the stage, I remember watching them walk out of the tent, like seeing them mid-show decide like, yeah, this is not,
this one's not happening.
And there was a moment in it where it was one of the greatest things in a life of you doing great things that I think are great. This is one of the best. You refused to like take it from this audience who was like starting to grumble and starting to heckle a little bit. You were just like, oh, I'm sorry. Dude, like you went at them.
Oh, yeah, there's a guy who's like, oh, no, the guy in the tool shirt doesn't like this.
Yeah.
Something like
that. And it was like
singling out one guy.
I remember thinking that was like the bolt of confidence that I just needed at that moment so that I could stay up here and not cry or what, like.
Yeah.
And it was just one. And didn't we end doing like Under Pressure?
We did Under Pressure. Yeah. And then I remember we took tremendous pride in getting off the grounds of the festival in like, it was 9 minutes. It was insane. Matthew was with us like, yeah, we're going to get out of here in 10 minutes after we're done.
We were in the car.
And I texted our booking agent, we are never doing that again.
Yeah, that was, look, God bless them for trying. Yeah. That one didn't add up.
You need to go through something like that to just sort of, both to appreciate how it's 90% great most of the time, and also just to sort of get that, that callous.
Oh,
happening, you know?
It was like I'm not going to say, oh, it's so much better when you eat it every once in a while. It's like, no, it'd be perfect if we never ate it ever. But it was definitely, there was value came from it that.
Oh, yeah.
Because then it was just like, wow, okay, it can go that way. Whoa, yeah. Okay. So it informed our decisions. If people are looking at the summer festivals coming up and saying like, oh, I wonder which ones John and Tom might be on this upcoming summer for the festival season. None of them. Like, and then this goes for every year going forward, I would probably say.
Not even a rock and roll comedy fest, I don't think.
Yeah. If there was one... I don't know if I would do Sharpling and Worcester Fest. I might still think anything with fest in it is just going to be that much trickier.
I would do something if we could involve Eddie Trunk in it.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Like
I would
a
do
metal fest and he was part of our thing.
If we could interview Eddie Trunk on stage.
Oh, so great.
Well, here's one. How much would you pay? I would do it for free. I don't know if I would actually pay. I would be like, okay. Oh, if this is just for the experience, I'll take it on the chin and do it for free.
Oh, yeah.
To talk. Just like, I don't want to lose money on it.
No. And we would have to just drop as many references to like Big Star and like the Minutemen.
These bands, he has no... It's the most fascinating thing where... Mm-hmm. I told you Eddie Trunk, he's this metal guy. He does this metal radio show. He's been doing it for years. He had a VH1 classic show that we were both obsessed with called That Metal Show. And with Jim Florentine and Don Jameson, his two co-hosts. And it was one of those shows that was so amazing. Clearly, they could never get the clearance to ever play any song ever, including the house musician. They would have a metal. They'd be like, hey, we got Vivian Campbell's here from Dio, and he's here today. He's providing the music. And he would just go, just playing. But he couldn't play like, he couldn't do like a Dio riff. Because that would be publishing. It would that you'd yeah. have to pay publishing.
They would just recognizable.
They would kind of just like jack it on their guitar, kind of just solos. So we've been obsessed with this guy. He did an episode recently. I called you and just had to tell you that he didn't know, like some guest was talking about Glenn Matlock and Eddie was kind of just like, he just clearly had no idea who that was. But what are, I know you know the answer to this. What are name?
I know the question before you're even going to ask.
Exactly.
It. All right.
Well, ask, all right. Say the question then.
All right. I think the question is, what non-metal? Yep. What two non-metal bands does he like? Yeah.
You know it.
Yeah. And they're pretty obvious. One's incredibly obvious.
Yeah.
The Foo Fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, I give him some points for it, but. I know he does his appreciation of this band includes none of what I would call their good work.
Yeah, like their glory days.
Soul Asylum. Yeah.
There's one more.
Oh.
A band from the 70s. A band from the
I don't know this.
A maybe. Band from the 70s. I would say this. A band from the 70s who influenced Kiss power pop.
Oh, yes. Raspberries.
The Raspberries, yes. That's the other one that he has three. Foo Fighters, yeah. It's like the set. He has the one from the 70s, the Raspberries.
Yeah.
His 80s into, well, his Soul Asylum one is definitely more 90s than 80s, his love of Soul Asylum. Like hearing him talk about Soul Asylum and he'll just be like, yeah, they got this like whip, cottage cheese and all the thing. It's like the Herb Alpert, like he's not even getting it right. Like, you know, they got these albums, Hang Time. I don't know about that one. Like, he's not even on board for that. That's when it's kind of like, I'm starting to say like, hey, best of luck to you guys in your future endeavors. And he's just going like, knock, knock, knock. Hey, what's going on in there? But I would interview him. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
To sit down with Eddie Trunk.
Someone did buy the both of us a cameo from Eddie Trunk.
Really? I never saw this.
Did you see this? No. Oh my God. Yes. God, who, I have no idea who
I've
actually
never seen this.
Sent it, but it was someone, I can't remember who sent it, but basically he was giving us a super quick hey John and Tom, understand God. You guys are fans, and John, you're a drummer and that's cool, and Tom, I hear you're a DJ now. I can't believe you haven't seen this.
I have not seen this.
God, well, if anyone's listening, resend it, because I have no memory of who sent this.
Please I'm begging you.
It was good. I mean, it was you could tell like he had been given a two sentence primer, and that was it.
Yeah, just reading the quickie things. It just somebody
did
once,
did I ever send you my Frank Stallone cameo?
No.
that Rachel Lichtman bought me. Oh no. My God, we have this ongoing joke, you know the song by the greatest named band of all time, Climax. Precious and Few. Yeah. That song.
Yeah, yeah.
The lyric is precious and few are the moments we two can share. And Rachel and I, our long running joke is precious and few are the moments we two can, Sam. And so she paid for him to say hello and to sing that for me.
Oh my God.
He put so little effort into this. He's in bed and he's shirtless. Like, he didn't even put a shirt on.
Unbelievable.
And so he just starts talking, and it was pretty long talk. It was pretty fun. And then I can't remember if he sang the song or not. He might have sang just the original chorus to it, but I could tell he was not super into it because I was a guy and he was singing it to a guy. So that was that. Yeah.
Oh, and just as a footnote, when we got back to Seattle from that Sasquatch, I think we both decided we're not going to hang out tonight. We're just going to go like lick our wounds separately. We were both like, so like it was like,
we had a good dinner. Remember that? We had a good upscale Mexican dinner.
Yes. We had a good dinner, but then it was just kind of like, I'm just going to go hide right now.
And yeah. This sucks. We're going back to the hotel.
Yeah. But it was also just like, I'm just going to go to my room at seven and just sit in it. Until I have to get on the plane tomorrow.
Yeah.
No, that was, that is so far. I got a cameo. A friend got me a cameo. This is the worst thing you could ever do. A friend got me a cameo of a comedian that we both know, not saying that I was the Tom in it. And it's the most uncomfortable thing ever experience when somebody's just like, hey, Tom, I just want to say it's, and it's like, you know me, we talk on the phone and you're doing this thing now, not realizing.
Generic.
Yeah. Hey, Tom, it's real cool. I heard you're into it. Like, oh, no, I didn't even make it all the way through.
Oh, no.
And then there was a really good one that Jason Wallner got me of Chris Noth from like well after his cancellation.
Yeah.
And he talked for a very long time on it about it. Actually made me, I swear, I teared up watching it because this guy is saying how his life is basically, he's like, like, yeah, you know, your friend Jason wanted to say happy birthday, and you know, friends are important, and you know, friends have gotten me through a lot of the stuff. As you know, I'm going through stuff now, and if I didn't have friends, I don't know. I was just like, oh my God, this guy is opening a vein on these cameos. Like, he's letting it all hang out there. It was pretty intense. Gareth wants to know which double acts throughout the history of comedy do we both love, and have we ever seen anything out there that seems to owe a debt to what we've done?
I gotta say, and maybe I'm wrong, I really don't know any of anyone else kind of tackling what we do. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I can't think of anyone else that does this, and I'm not saying that's not like a horn toot, but I really don't know of anyone else who's doing this in the way we do it.
Me neither. I'll hear little like faint traces of a style of joke or something that I'm just like, I think we were really doing that. Like, that's that, like, I could feel like, that maybe that traces back to us, but nobody's like hardcore doing the thing.
No.
Because, and our thing, I think one of the things that make our dynamic work is that we never planned for it to be a thing.
No.
We met it for wherever it grew to and have continued to do that. It's not like we're just like doing like calculated strategizing and things like that. We kind of just be like, hey, what if we try this? What if we try that? Or let's do this. But we've never like really done it from like business first.
Never.
It's always been kind of like, this is making us laugh. Let's do this. Well, what if we also did this other? Let's put it on a CD, for example, because we'd love for people to hear the thing that's making us laugh more.
Yeah. There was never any sort of business model or career plan at all. And I think that's why it's so much fun. And that's why I feel like that's why it connects with people, because we're trying, but I don't think it feels like we're trying, you know, super hard to make people think of us in a certain way. You know what I mean?
We're not trying to make people think of us. And we're also not saying like, what's the version of this that we can get the most money out of, for example. Like, that's never driven any decision making for us doing this. It's never been just like biggest offer wins.
No, and I think that has a lot to do with us both being heirs to huge fortunes.
Of course. Well, look, if we didn't have this generational wealth that we could always count on, we would not be this. We would not be this confident in our approaching this artistically.
Right.
I kind of think, though, sometimes not having that money makes you less scared than having the money. Like I know people who come from money and they make more decisions based on getting more money than I come across for people who don't have money, are kind of just like, yeah, I'm just going to do my stuff. Like, money's just not, money was never like a part of the core decision-making for me.
Never.
In things.
No.
Not for you. It just, and I think that's because we didn't have it. It's not like.
No. Well, we don't come from money at all. So that was never in the picture for us at all. Like, I think we both just, you know, our parents didn't make much money. So we just didn't expect to make money either. I didn't.
I just wanted to do is like, I just want to be able to like go see movies when I want to see them and buy like books that I want, and not like, that to me has always been the line where it's just like, if somebody puts a $50 book out, I'd pull the trigger on that without thinking twice. But like, that's kind of the upper limit of that in a way.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, it never goes so incredibly far past that where you'll buy like you bought a crazy Kiss book years ago. And it was just like, but you did that, but that's kind of the ceiling now.
It was signed by all four too. I mean, how can I pass that up?
No, you can't. And I mean, you probably are going to be spending about 10 grand to see them at Madison Square Garden this December. But beyond that, you'll
playing their songs as slow as possible.
Oh my God. Could you imagine? Just like that moment of sag where it sags.
Did they stop?
Yeah. No. They're still doing Detroit Rock City.
Oh.
We just want to tell you that we would not exist without you. Talk. Like, so it's like, then why are you charging us so much for everything? Like, you're so important to us. There would be no Kiss without you. Why do we pay for everything then? Like, why? You don't ever pay us.
Right?
Like, if this is such a mutual exchange. No, we give you the same set again and again. When's the last time you think they've made, like, substantial set change adjustments?
They haven't really in the last probably five years. When they do, when they play in the UK, it's my understanding they do that song Crazy Nights because it was a genuine hit there.
Okay.
And that there's a song called Shandy, which is on Unmasked. Mm-hmm. Didn't do anything here, but giant song in Australia, and they'll do it there.
Okay.
But so. I think those are the two big ones. Oh, getting back to the question, who was the duo that
oh yeah,
that had they had records out and it came out on CD?
Coyle and Sharp.
Coyle and Sharp. That's it. Yes, that's it.
Yeah,
would not have pulled that out. Yeah,
Jim and, Coyle and Mal Sharp. They were San Francisco based.
Yeah,
on the street, and they were like adults. They're like middle-aged looking guys in the early 60s wearing suit and tie on the street with a microphone or looking as official as you can look. And they would ask people on the street the strangest things, but they looked like authority figures. And people would respond accordingly. They would answer, well, this guy is asking me a question. He clearly can't be some sort of trickster, he's in a suit. So they would answer the questions, and they were the silliest, weirdest, most surreal questions that you could ask somebody, and they would get people to try to seriously answer these questions. That was big in terms of early on, we had more of a potential let's fool the audience part of things, a little, like keeping the audience confused of whether this was real or not, or whatever right. It was, or maybe getting callers to call up and argue with stuff. But whenever we did that, it would always inevitably be the, this is fake. Second call. Right. This is fake. This is fake. It's like, and then there was just one day where we were both like, let's just not do that anymore. Let's just be funny for ourselves and not have to like loop in the callers who are trying to pop the balloon all the time.
Right.
Fake.
Yeah, that sucked.
So yeah, but that was and also for me, Bob and Ray was big for me. Chris Elliott's father, Bob Elliott. Who else? Who were like actual duos?
Did Avery Fisher have a partner? I feel like I had an album. Wasn't that his name?
Avery Shriver.
Avery Shriver. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Didn't he have a partner? Did they make a record? I feel like that I had a record. I don't remember who his partner was though.
But I guess what we're saying through talking about this is like, not really.
No.
There wasn't really a duo where we were like, that's what we want. Oh, you know who was important to me actually would have been Sloven and Allen in New York.
I don't know if I ever saw them. I don't think I ever saw
Eric Sloven and Leo Allen did like a two-person thing, but their thing was like subverting a very traditional version of a two-person thing on stage. They were almost doing that like equivalent of like, you know, there's a lot of this, like that kind of thing, but they would get so weird. Their show was they were very funny together. They were a part of that whole New York City downtown kind of Luna Lounge eating it scene.
Right.
But again, not a one-to-one thing at all. Our thing kind of just took shape. We kind of watched it take shape in a strange way.
Oh yeah.
Like we were spectators to it. It's almost like, should we do another one of these? Like that was kind of how it was. Yeah, let's do another one. What should we do? And then jump forward and we're still saying the same thing, kinda. Let me see. One final question and then we'll well, here you go. Darren wants to know, this is one that I know you're gonna think is right up my alley. How would you rank the big four in terms of lead vocals? My vote would be number one, Mustaine, number two, Hetfield, number three, Belladonna, and number four, whoever that was singing for Slayer.
I think Dave Mustaine, I'm looking to see if he's here, has a terrible voice. Oh. I don't like his voice at all. So I'm shocked that someone would put him first.
Me too.
It's
always like he growls a lot rather than sing.
Yeah. And he goes kind of high. I think Hetfield And I'm not a Metallica fan, but I have genuine respect for James Hetfield. I think he's one of the greatest rhythm guitar players of all time. Like, maybe the best. Just, like, impenetrable. Just incredible. And I think his singing is good, too. I think he's got some stuff. You know, I think he can do a bunch of different things. And I think that speaks to why they were the only of those bands that actually had, like, breakthrough across the board hit records. I don't think Anthrax had like a hit song, did they? I mean,
I'm the man, like, of course.
And it's like an undeniable hit song, right?
I know you
song,
like I'm
right?
the man and Bring the Noise. But those are like novelty almost to
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
It's not what they actually yes. did.
I worked at a record store and one day Scott Ian came in the store right as I was coming in. It was November 22nd, so it was the anniversary of JFK's assassination, probably 89.
Okay.
And I walk in the store and I see him and he's eating a slice of pizza. and I go, "Hey, Scott." And he just still has the pizza and he just goes, "Sup." And he just kept walking out the door. So, fuck off. So,
that, we have a fair amount of pizza related comedy also. There's, we're not going to say who, like, you got snaked at a pizzeria 20 years ago by another band, by a member of another band.
It was one of those bands. There are two bands that I always confuse. One is called, fuck, what are they called?
Well, I know who you, should we bleep it out? I mean,
no, I think they'll appreciate that.
It was Velocity so Girl, long. Right?
Oh, I thought it was, no, I think you're right. I thought it was either, God, what the fuck are these bands called?
Tsunami?
No, Essex Green, and who was the other band that was like Essex Green?
Oh, the ones from New Jersey?
What were they called? Not Spent.
Ladybug Transistor?
Ladybug Transistor. I thought it was a Ladybug Transistor person, but it might have been Velocity
Girl. It was
Girl.
Velocity Girl. It was Archie from Velocity Girl. I think it was literally Archie from Velocity Girl.
It was in Boston. Okay. Yeah.
He like was in front of you at a pizzeria and got the slice you wanted. And I remember just like... And this has zero to do actually with Archie from or anyone. No. It was just funny that you were just like, you told me, it's like, yeah, like, hey, how you doing? How's the tour? And you're just like, well, yeah, the smallest of small conversation. Just like, yeah, you know, so-and-so was getting pizza after the show and he was in front of me and the thing and he got that slice I wanted so bad. And he snaked me on that last slice. And we just like turned nothing into something in terms of joking between the two of us.
Yeah.
I think it became a call because it was based on so much stuff we do is based on if you tell me something or I tell you something and then the other one says, what if you did this in reaction to that?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what if you overreacted so much to that slice and then, like, got revenge on someone for snaking you on a slice and thinking it's equal. Like, well, that was fair. You deserved that.
I took all the tubes out of Archie's amp.
Yeah.
Before the show.
And then it's like, well, why would you do that?
Well, he took my pizza slice.
Well, that's not. He didn't. First of all, he didn't take your slice. He was just ahead of you. He was in line ahead of you.
Yeah, but I was the headliner.
It's so, like...
Yeah, but he was the opener.
Yeah. He's supposed to defer, and that's that's how a call gets built, I guess.
Yeah.
As far as that list goes, I would agree with... Like, James Hetfield ultimately has a rock voice.
Yes.
Like, yeah. he's got, like, a solid... rock music voice, not just a metal voice, which is, I think, what makes that them kind of transcend the genre.
Right.
Which is, you know, and yeah, And whoever's singing from Slayer, that's
Tom Araya.
Yes, who's retired now, right?
Yes, he had some severe neck issues from headbanging.
Mm-hmm. Well, he served, and he can rest easy knowing that the catalog stands and isn't going
right.
anywhere. I end up hearing these Slayer records because we do this Rick Rubin career review
yeah.
thing. So I've listened to more Slayer this year than I've ever heard in my entire life.
Yeah.
And I get it though. I do get it.
Not my thing. Although I think Dave Lombardo, one of the greatest drummers of all time. I like to psych up for like a Bob Mould show watching him play. Like
wow.
there's some videos that's just him from behind.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did Riot Fest a few years ago, and Dave was playing with Suicidal Tendencies, and
okay.
I got to like watch him from just like feet away. It was really cool.
Wow.
It was really cool. Like he's just like, he's one of those guys where it's just like, it's so floaty. It's like, it's not just, it's like,
yeah.
he's just like, and no effort, doesn't warm up apparently, just gets up there and just is amazing.
That's
so.
Wild. Now that's so cool. And that's also
Kudos.
One of the exciting things about, we do these things and we kind of get to see things that
yeah.
we both really try to appreciate, that we get into weird spots and can see things.
I got to see Sarah Silverman play here in Raleigh a few days ago, or in Durham, and she has family here. And I went backstage just to say hello, and it was me.
Uh-huh.
And what was like 25 of her extended family members.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring this up just because it's something I would never have gotten to experience had we not had whatever entree we get. But that was really fun because she was just like, and you are so-and-so's son, and I haven't seen you since you were 5. Like, she was just
wow.
able to
Piecing.
Call these names, and I would never have gotten to see that.
No, that's amazing.
It's exciting stuff.
Yeah,
it's exciting.
No, it's yeah, we're both pretty lucky in that regard.
Yeah, I've never met a Beatle. Have you?
No.
No.
I don't
I've
know.
I've only met one Rolling Stone.
Which one?
Mick Taylor.
That's cool. I mean, that's like, that's my, in that slot, I know a lot of people, Nicole Lawrence, for example, that's her Rolling Stones is the Mick Taylor stuff. Like
oh,
that
yeah.
is like,
yeah,
she's like, that's cool. like that's her prime stuff. So that's huge.
Yeah. I've never met anyone in the Who.
You should have gone to Woodstock 99. You could have met John Entwistle, who played it. That is still one of the strangest things. Imagining him rolling into this Air Force base, just being like, just, yeah, let's do it. What should we start? Should we start with the Quiet One?
Or Heaven and Hell?
And we'll end with Boris the Spider, of course. My Wife. And we'll play something called Smash Your Head. What was the album?
Yeah. Smash Your Head Against the Wall. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Into the Wall?
Yes. One of his great solo albums.
Oh, my God.
Too Late the Hero was another.
Too Late the Hero.
And Whistle solo album. Oh, my God. Yeah. So I've never met a Beatle. Never met anybody from Rolling Stones.
I never met Bruce. I remember. Oh, you might have seen him. Remember when I was playing with Whiskey Town,
mm-hmm.
and we played at is it called the Garden State Art Center? Is that what it's called?
Yes. And I saw you. You were opening for John Fogerty.
For John Fogerty, and I came off stage, and who do I see right there? Bruce and Max. They had come to see
mm-hmm.
John. Interaction. But I remember you and I sitting in a booth backstage afterwards, just kind of working on stuff.
Yes, exactly. It was kind of just like, I went to the show, saw it, then we're both like, let's pop out and kick
yeah.
some ideas around.
Yeah.
No, that was one funny thing you told me, that somebody said something.
The curse.
Oh, wait, what was that?
Is the curse? Oh, well.
I was going to do the Bill Clinton thing.
Oh, okay. I didn't say this during our last discussion, but okay, when the opportunity came up, but I'll say it now.
Okay.
When I played with this band Marat from Philly, these two brothers we spoke about during the last Q&A we did. Anyway, so they had been taken under Bruce had taken them under his wing a little bit. So this is like 2002 and 3. And so our first show of a big tour, it's like the whole country, was at the is it called the Saint in Asbury Park?
Yeah.
The Saint.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy comes and he's Bruce adjacent, and his, I don't know what his real name is, but his nickname in Jersey is Baja Galoop. I don't know what it means, but he was like maybe went to high school with Bruce or played in those bands around the same time as Steel Mill and Earth and et cetera. And so he goes, so like, he's just so like no filter. Hey, you guys know about the curse, right? And the guys, Morago, no, what are you talking about? Oh, anyone Bruce likes and really champions, they never get anywhere.
Oh my God.
But it's kind of true.
Yeah. Iron City House Rockers.
I'm not going to name any more, but there's at least five of them.
There's a few, just people who he's truly championed as saying like, this person is amazing, and I'm hopping on stage whenever they come to town.
Right.
And look, the idea of making it or breaking through is such a lot. It's like hitting the lottery, even when you're in the door,
right,
as a working musician and working artist. Yeah. The idea of like going to that next level it's kind of out of your control.
Yes. We'll say that. None of them made it to that next level.
Yeah. And it's just not, it's not even a judgment on anybody's talent or anything. Those are the factors that you just have to, ride the ride, I guess. And I was going to say the thing about, wasn't there a thing where John Fogerty, where Bill Clinton talked to John Fogerty, that you told me that like John Fogerty met Bill Clinton at a thing backstage, and Fogerty was like, hey, sorry about all this Monica Lewinsky stuff you got. Like, do you remember this?
I don't know if I told, I don't know this. I don't remember
well,
this.
Well, maybe, yeah. And he was just, and Bill Clinton
maybe
was like,
me.
Bill Clinton, no, it was definitely you, because you were close. And he was like, yeah, you know, it's a bunch of bullshit or whatever. Like, they're coming after me. They're like, that's what Bill Clinton said to John Fogerty.
Oh, wow.
That like, yeah, I mean, you were not there for that, but you were not there for that, but I think you heard it on that tour.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
He only came to say hello to Whiskey Town once, and I wasn't in the room.
That
moment
sucks.
And yeah. I never met him. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, he'll be back tomorrow. It's like, no, he won't.
Nope. He would arrive 5 minutes before, like, he'd arrive in an RV while the house lights had just come down. Like, didn't sound check.
Wow.
Would show up with his family and just walk from the Winnebago.
Just walk
the
from
stage.
The Winnebago. Bonino. Just like knowing. Yeah. That he just can kick right into it. Well, good for him.
Yeah.
Well, this is amazing. This is so much fun to do. And
yes,
we appreciate all the questions, and people can keep sending questions in over at the Patreon patreon.com/thebestshow. So keep sending in questions, and we'll keep doing these. And thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Best Show is produced in partnership with the Forever Dog Podcast Network. The show is hosted by Tom Sharpling and features John Worster, Michael Lisk, Jason Gore, and Pat Byrne. The show is produced and written by Jason Gore, Pat Byrne, Michael Lisk, Brett Davis, John Worster, and Tom Sharpling. The Best Show is executive produced by Tom Sharpling, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Co-executive produced by Jason Gore and Pat Byrne, segment producer Michael Lisk. The show is engineered and mastered by Andrew Gleason and Wesley Knapp. Graphic design, video editing, and social media by Brett Davis. Website and technical support by Martine Sellis. And the show is recorded at Forever Dog Studios in Los Angeles.
support The Best Show on Patreon over at patreon.com/thebestshow, and follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Best Show for Life. That's Best Show 4 Life. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.